the honourable member. I'm saying mainly to honourable Fraley and those who were not together with us last week, because right now we're already mourning about the fatigue from the Mthatha and Devon trip. Very, very hot. In any case, let me welcome everyone. Let me welcome everyone to the first meeting of the Portfolio Committee for Energy this year, this centenary year. It would just be helpful before I even proceed just to indicate that the main culprits for today, the Presidential Review SOE Committee, is on its way. They seem to have taken to flight this morning. The Secretary just said that they are on their way. However, given that it's a new year, and also it's the year of the dragon, so it must be an exciting year for all of us this year. Can I just allow us to introduce ourselves whilst we are waiting for the team from the Presidential Review to come? We all know the honourable members, don't we? Just at this side, my left. Although the personal status is more than popular in the energy sector.
Thank you. My name is Andegar Zongo. I'm the COO from the Department of Energy.
Good morning, colleagues. My name is Umesh Natha. I'm from NEXA.
Morning, everyone. My name is Nomalanga Tole. I'm the Executive Manager for Corporate Services at NEXA.
Good morning. My name is Vetu McKenzie. I'm the Senior Manager in the CEO's office, also from NEXA.
Morning, Chen. Honourable members, my name is Boyce Mkize from the National Nuclear Regulator, CEO. Thanks.
My name is Aguila Osman, acting CEO of NEA.
Wendell Rothreiters.
My name is David Maguma, Senior Manager for Working for Energy in the
Auditor General.
My name is Zanele Keto from the Auditor General.
Good morning, Chair Members. My name is Kaiser Natsumba with PetroSA.
Morning, Honorable Members. My name is Nsutuga Makiva, PetroSA.
Are there anyone who does not want to be known behind us?
My name is Sidney Mpepu, a researcher for the committee.
For the next few days.
Mahalo for Star Parliamentary Communication Services.
Thank you very much.
Morning, everyone. Chilesha from PMG.
Morning, Mandla Kiala from SEF.
Ivan Collier from Shell.
Morning, honourable members. Mike Stead from NGEN.
Thank you very much. Well, Christians are making a good start in our meeting. Thanks very much for that. Well, we can see we've got quite a wide range of people who are attending the media as well, the oil or petrochemical industry, and also the SOEs in this area. Thanks very much for coming at a short notice. We just realized, you know, that if we are to get this presentation by the Presidential Review SOE Committee, it is appropriate that the SOEs also are represented so that they can get an exposure. We don't want to assume, because it's a presidential committee, that from time to time we are interacting with it. We want to ensure that we go along with you in all the deliberations and interactions with this committee, because it is a vital committee, and it is definitely going to impact quite significantly on the work that you're doing, your future, and also your programs, definitely. Maybe it would be nice just to have a few minutes just to reflect on last year, and maybe what we need to do before that is to get our committee secretary to dispense with attendance issues.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've received two apologies from Honourable, one from Honourable Matibela, who's still on sick leave, and Honourable Fadebe, who's currently on an oversight visit with the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training, KZN, Chairperson. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Last year has been a very hectic year for all of us. In energy. Amongst other things we did in the first quarter was to put together a strategic plan which aimed to guide us in our work. And I trust, honorable members, at some stage we'll go and dig it out of our shelves and just reflect on it and see if there are any areas that you feel strongly that we need to cover this year. I know for sure that there was a number of areas that we would have loved to cover last year, but we couldn't. At times we consciously didn't, because the department had promised us reports on them. An example is the energy efficiency strategy. Another example is the liquid fuels, charter. There obviously could be a few others that we're waiting to get reports on. And I'll be very, very keen, Mamzungu, then at some stage you together with whoever you assign in any case, and together with the parliamentary liaison officer and our committee secretary, to just go through and see which of those reports we are expecting, because they obviously are going to influence our planning, you know, for this year. I'm sure all of us are looking forward to get an update at some stage with good timing as to how did the first phase of the procurement on IPPs went, but definitely we'll be guided by the department as well as NERSA. And I'm sure also would agree that at some stage we need to give some time and look at international issues, to look at the nuclear energy, to look at just have a good grip on renewable energy once again, whether it's through IRP3 or whatever. But we will work on that. One of the areas that could be helpful that we look into is also things like the department's public participation program. Because much as we focus on what is being delivered regarding energy, it is also important to see the extent to which the public is encouraged to participate, or we create an environment and platform for the public to respond. Obviously, we'll also be guided and work with the department on such areas. And as you can see, even the picture shows, although we're not here for the refineries, I don't know that the committee secretary was quite excited about last week's trip, that he decided to give a very nice and exciting reminder of what we went through last week. But obviously we will have to have constructed report on that. Another member that, sure, it would be also appropriate that if I can just allow any of you just to reflect on last year and see if we feel that we have done the best good and how we can strengthen and reinforce things for this year. I know I'm parachuting and bouncing on you, but it doesn't mean that you can't just put a few points. And of course, it's always good to have a collective approach in handling such kind of things. Dr. Lucas, you would like to kick off?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chairman. I think I must say first that you showed very good leadership qualities in leading this committee. The one thing that worries me is the issue of the Karoo and the shale gas. What are we going to do? Because we seem to be stick back, and I thought we should look at that.
Anyone else? Going. Another failing?
Yeah, I think just two issues that immediately come to mind is the integrated energy plan and what the progress is on that. And I think also the issue of distribution and what's happening to distribution networks and municipalities and what the overall plan is. I think we really need to get to grips with that this year. So I think that's something that we need to focus on.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. For me, it's about the biofuels and the long time that it took us to get some regulations out in terms of compulsory blending, and that there's still a bit of uncertainty regarding the percentage added to the mix. And that we've heard now in our oversight in KwaZulu that for petroleum we can add the 2% that's currently allocated, that we can increase that percentage, and that would might mean a lot to industry. So regarding the biofuels, I think we still need to refine a few issues. And then on pricing of electricity, also what you've mentioned in terms of the stat plan, I think that area is a bit vague in terms of the methodology in which pricing is calculated. And currently we know they use the cost of replacement of assets, and I know that inflates the prices, and I think we have to have a relook at pricing. And just to add to Honourable Graylin, yes, indeed the distribution has been a thorny issue for a long time, perhaps because of constitutional problems. But we have to look at the funding of how we can solve this problem. Those are the issues, is, to me, very important.
Madam
Chair, thank you. Just a couple of things. So, one of my serious problems is the understaffing at the Department of Energy. You know, when we have a situation where we don't have enough inspectors to do the jobs that they have to do at filling stations or any other place where we need to know what's happening, things can go wrong, especially safety issues and stuff like that. So that's very, very serious. But I think the problem will be compounded if the department is not able to get the resources, the human resources that they deserve, when we go into the IPP program. You know, there are going to be new establishments coming up. Those things need to be inspected. We've got to make sure that they're up to spec. And if we don't have the people to do it, we have some serious problems to deal with. The other one is something that has come up recently, and we looked at it, but we need to pay even more attention to it. This is the whole issue of how the refineries and all of those people who are involved in the liquid fuels industry relate and work with one another, especially where you have situations of shortages or threatened shortages. So we need to find a way of us working together without people feeling like there is collusion or anything like that. Otherwise, the economy is going to suffer even more as we go on, especially if we do get the growth that we wish we can get to create those jobs. So it's something that we need to look at. Thanks.
Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Mine is on pretty basic electricity and the and the municipalities and the fact that people don't access this and also the energy saving education, and that relates to public participation. Thank you, Chair.
Shall I let off the lid, come off the hook? I know he's catching his breath. I wish you could. No, welcome. Madam Long, whilst we're waiting for the team to come, we're just reflecting on last year and just off the cuff, just, you know, brainstorming a few things that we feel should be handled this year. You see. Now, I'm very glad that issues have been raised, you know, and in quite a number of instances, they resonate, the issues that we realized that were quite important and were outstanding from last year. That look at the shale gas issue, that's a touchy thing. I'm sure as we have seen at times in the media, the way it's being handled, it seems as if it's already on our table. It's the moratorium, it's the interaction between the two departments, the MR and NAG, the cabinet level. But we assume and expect that it will come at some stage here. Unless we feel that I'm overcautious, I don't want to jump the gun, if I can put it like that. But we really expect it to be brought to our attention at the appropriate time. I'm glad that the issue of IRP has been strengthened and resonated. I'm sure the department can work out something on that. Of course, it has always been regarded as an iterative issue. The energy distribution industry, fortunately, it's part of our issues that we'll handle this month, I mean this term, that is up to March. But the approach is that we'll invite other portfolio committees, so that, as usual, as well as SALCA. But this time, we'd like to be a little bit more robust on it. Honorable Ross, the biofuels, I'm sure Umam Zung can guide us. I don't want to be inaccurate. I assume that the draft regulations have been out or something like that, or they are there, you know, publishing is imminent. If you could just work on that to that timing. You've been raising it for some time now, and we have those expectations. The pricing of electricity, that's one of the items we'll be looking at. ESCOM and ERSA will come at some stage once the Speaker's Office adopts our proposed program for this term. We really want to get an appropriate exposure to it, to
MIPD, the concept and practice, the rationale behind MIPD, and also an overview of the MIPD too, very, very thoroughly. I'm not sure whether it has been done in the past as a newcomer, but if not, then we definitely will go through it and be as elaborate as possible so that we're clear and we're able to conduct, you know, appropriate oversight on how that whole field is being worked. Honorable Mutau, very interestingly, this morning, here is a correspondence that comes from the speaker's office himself. Our BRRR has been formally forwarded to the Minister of Energy. So that's very interesting. I'm running away from the full name, but as you know, the budget review report, let's just call it that, the budget review report, as it is, as we worked on it last year, they even attached the copy as if we don't have, but of course, I'm sure it's just the formality. It's there, it's submitted. And what is striking is that, if I can quote, it says, in terms of the Act, this report must be submitted to the Minister of Finance and the member of Cabinet responsible for the vote which the report applies. So if you could just remind yourself at some stage, just run through the recommendations. I know the first recommendation is very clear. It says, the Department of Energy, Public Service and Administration, and National Treasury should sit down and look at how they can address specifically issues that affect the department. And there were specific personnel, as we have said, regional offices and international departments. I mean, running an international department in an energy sector with a staff of 3 instead of 16. Am I accurate? 3, 5. Oh, you've grown a little bit. 5, but still 5 compared to 16, and people have got to run around and handle hydrocarbons and handle nuclear energy and handle renewable energy and handle everything, negotiations and all of that. So I can say we're on track, but of course, then it means the reality is we've got to be quite serious about the cycle as we articulated it last year so that you can get a feedback at some stage as to what happened to our recommendations. From FBE to FPE, Mamutintu, from free basic electricity to free basic energy, both of them, at some stage, we need to engage with the state-owned enterprises, Mamutungu, obviously, or NERSAS, and whoever else on that area. Let's give it its full attention. Probably, without thinking off the cuff, it might even be helpful to do it a little bit from a public hearings angle, you know, because you also emphasize issues like access, isn't it? So that's very important. It's rather limited if you just are going to handle, you know, free basic energy or electricity from just getting reports. But we'll work on that. Thanks very much, honorable members. Now that the Makulu bus from the president's office is here, we hand over to them. Once again, I'm sure we all know that at some stage the president of the country set up a program to review state-owned enterprises. And then, late last year, the Speaker's office assigned all committees, literally all committees, to invite the committee to come and present their work hitherto and share with us whatever is happening. I trust everyone has got a copy, and it's a copy that at a personal level one has been exposed to previously. However, really if possible, I would appeal to Mamu Piecha if they have been able to at least try as much as they can to be biased to the energy sector, if possible. I know we picked that up at a later stage. Honestly, we're of the impression that the interaction and the correspondence did articulate that quite clearly, which is one of the reasons why we said we would like, from the speaker's office, that they would like to ensure that, the committee visits probably all the parliamentary committees to articulate the work they have done up to now and the likely impact and, whatever projections they have. From PSA, we have our state-owned enterprises invited as well so that they can have first-hand information about what their future is. I hope you're not going to say we should be swallowed match and whatever. But the floor is yours now. Let's hand over to you. Please take us through your presentation. Thanks very much.
Good morning, Chair. First, let me thank you on behalf of the PLC for the opportunity to come and meet with the portfolio committee and engage on this very crucial matter of the review of state-owned enterprises. As you've already indicated, a number of members around the table may have already seen our presentation, and I apologize if we didn't nuance our presentation towards the energy sector. It might have been an oversight in communication, but I'm glad that I see some of the chairpersons and entity heads that we've had an engagement with, and I'm hoping that they may be able to also shed some light on some of the issues that they raised with us. The areas of focus of the Commission are of a macro analysis nature and would allow the membership and the people around the table to be able to engage, and we would be able to give probably high-level responses to some of the issues that may be raised and the questions that we may be given. I do want to say we are far down in the process of the review, with our report almost due in the next 2 or 3 months. The review that we are conducting, we are doing against the backdrop of sentiments that have been strongly expressed around the need to strengthen the role of state-owned enterprises to ensure that those that are commercial, for instance, whilst remaining financially viable. And I think the issue of viability should be underscored, because we've had this week, a report that was issued by Race Relations actually saying 50% of these entities are not profitable. And again, it's a huge debate around, do we talk viability, do we talk profitability? What is it that these entities should be doing? But these entities, while they remain viable, they clearly contribute towards defined public mandates in order to assist the state to achieve its objectives. It is also important that these entities, in doing so, they start supporting national developmental goals, whether it's the New Growth Path or IPEP and other prioritized goals of the state, because clearly government is saying this is a platform that I can use to contribute meaningfully towards the economy and the development of this country. We truly believe that this process, if gotten right, it will help the country to review contribution of SOEs to a number of areas, human capital involvement, infrastructure development, sustainable SOE business models, the balance of socioeconomic imperatives, and propose appropriate strategic frameworks for the running of these entities, bring in changes around how we recruit, how we deal with performance, and other related aspects in these SOEs. We were established sometime in May in 2010. A committee of 12 was appointed, And most of the people that are on that committee are having other full-time jobs. The commissioners are, the committee members are part-time. We are supported by a very limited secretariat. We were established as an independent committee, and we work from the offices of the CSIR, and we've had quite a challenging process, but an enriching process, I must say, Chairperson. We adopted a few guidelines and principles to assist us in dealing with this very wide-scoped task that we've been assigned to perform. First and foremost, for the committee and members around here, we were not asked to review enterprises only. Enterprises would mean, in our understanding, those entities that are largely commercial. But we were tasked to look broadly at entities, which involves agencies, regulators, and many other forms of establishment. That in itself, right at the beginning, started deepening the scope of our work. As you would know, if you take the schedules of the PFMA, we were informed right at the beginning that there are about 300 entities that are listed. When we keenly looked at that number, we thought it may be helpful for us to understand whether there are any subsidiaries, so that we can have an inkling of what sort of number of entities we're talking about. That exercise of mining the information led us to a point where now we can say, after some bit of cleaning and rationalization, we're talking about something like 590 entities, you know. And those will be sitting in the municipalities, in the provinces, as well as at the national level. That mapped out our process, because then it became very clear that there is no way that we can do a micro audit of all those entities. Our review, therefore, that focused on the macro examination of these entities. We also recognize the fact that nature doesn't allow any vacuums. In an area where there is so much to be done, a lot of environments have started conducting some reviews. We took it upon ourselves that where such work has already started taking place, we will then reach out and leverage on the work that is already being done. There are a number of national departments that are engaged in reviews. For example, the Department of Science and Technology a few years ago asked the OECD to do a review for them, and now they are reviewing the review. So there are a number of platforms. The provinces also have engaged in a number of reviews, so we're working with all those that have done reviews to see how we can leverage the work that they've already done. We also conduct this review against the backdrop of a lot of work that has been done in many other countries, and we are using those platforms as part of our learnings and looking at what is it that we can elevate from there to assist us in doing the work that we've been doing. We recognize also that we have a checkered a platform in terms of performance. There are areas that are doing well, and indeed we need to look at those and see whether there aren't, you know, best practice lessons that can be lifted and looked into for generalization purposes for SOEs that we are having. So our focus has been more on leveraging. Just in terms of timelines, the total project was 21 months. 3 months was for setup. We've had 12 months to do the review. We've had some slack of 2 or so months. And we, however, would like to keep towards the time frame that we've been allotted to deliver the final report at the end of March. The work that we did really recognized the fact that SOEs are not new in this country. When we looked at some of the history records, we learned that the first SOE was established in 1880. So therefore, we recognize the fact that these entities have played a critical role in the development of this country. It was therefore necessary for us to go back to try and look at what is it that these entities were used for, and also what went right, what didn't go right. Because it was important for us to do so, because the state has always been a shareholder of these entities. And that would help us to contextualize some of the challenges and the noises that have been made around the role of the shareholder in actually utilizing these entities to develop this country. It was important also for us to look at the period post-1994, to look at the treatment that was given to these entities, as well as the new development of new entities. I may mention at this point that of the sample that was put together for us by HSRC, the finding is that almost more than 50% of the entities were established post-1994. So it was interesting for us to look into that period to say what happened post that period. Did we pause to look at the inheritance of this SOEs and see whether they're aligned to the new agenda, or was it a situation where, you know, we took a black box and continued to run and did not ask whether this is a marathon race or a 100-meter race? Those were critical questions that we needed to answer. Those would help us to position to look at beyond 2010 processes. And again, the pool, as we continuously put it, has been the fact that we're talking about South Africa as a developmental state. What then becomes the role of these entities in this developmental state? How do they fulfill those imperatives that have been set out? What have we done in the process of this review? First and foremost, our role was to assess the SOE sector in terms of its structure as well as its reforming. We did that in aid of assisting, through our recommendation, a process that may help to propose a future strategy for our SOEs. The lack and the void in terms of an overarching common strategy for SOEs is expressed by a number of the stakeholders that we are talking to. In that regard, they point to the fact that there is a need for a common vision and a common outlook in terms of the role of these SOEs and what they need to do to contribute towards the development of this country. They allude to the fact that there are issues around the missions, the mandates, the objectives of these entities, because then it's got to talk to this common vision, common platform, common view of where the SOEs should be going. In that regard also, another area that has been highlighted is the issue of the performance of the SOEs, in particular around the criteria. Are the indicators for performance clearly articulated and understood by all, and as a shareholder, actually come out boldly to say this is what I'm looking for? Where do you bring in the balance in terms of socioeconomic imperatives to ensure that all those predetermined performance development goals are clear, as well as the viability goals are clear to those that are running these entities? In this process, if the issue of the vision and the strategy is then clear, another key area that we keenly looked into is what we would call an enabling environment. If you have the strategy, if you have the vision, if you have you have the know-how, it is important, therefore, for the owner of the businesses to actually start saying, is the environment in which they are operating enabling? And in that regard, there are a number of areas that we thought we should look into. Policies for strengthening and enabling this climate in which they are operating, issues relating to legislation and the regulatory framework, and in that regard, really, what seems to be emerging and what seems to be communicated by stakeholders is that that area is riddled with conflict, duplications, and all that, and it is necessary to look in that space to look at whether the legislative framework, the regulatory framework, is enabling sufficiently to allow these entities to perform optimally. That then will lead the process in actually looking at some of the immediate policy options that can be considered. A few is listed there, whether it's around governance, whether they are commercialized or non-commercialized, the public-private partnerships, the strategic focus, ownership-related aspects. The list is endless. Those are some of the options that we attempted to review through this process. And then there's the issue around evaluating organizational and managerial performance of these entities. These are talk to issues of viability, funding, service delivery, developmental goals, skills development, all those transformational aspects that are critical. At the end of it all, one of the other areas that we've looked at, which is not listed there, is the capacity aspect. Is there capacity for the shareholder to manage these entities? Is there capacity for governance to govern these entities? Is there sufficient capacity for executive management to actually run those? Because it is one of the backbone pillars that will be required to complete this process of making recommendations or of making the entities be the best that they can be. We informed ourselves through this process, you know, around the rationale for governments to create SOEs. Clearly, the entities are established to undertake commercial activities and to promote economic growth on behalf of government. They are established to improve service delivery for the benefit of citizens of a country. They are established to undertake infrastructure development and management in order to facilitate a number of, capital platforms, whether it's the development of the economy or the welfare and well-being of citizens. They are established to facilitate that through the infrastructure development. They are established to regulate certain sectors where competitive tariffs, fees, and other things are eminent. They are established to promote national values and heritage, largely those stewardship entities that we are having. They are established to ensure democratic and constitutional values are upheld. And when the private sector investors refuse to serve less profitable areas, market failures are indicated, and therefore there is need for intervention because perhaps the state could be able to activate interest or grow those areas for markets to have sufficient appetite to participate going forward. They are established to ensure constant reliable supply of life critical commodities such as energy and others. We looked at a problem statement, and we asked a number of questions. We've listed a few of those. It is common sense to us sitting around here that one of the key questions that are being asked is whether the failures of SOEs are exaggerated. We needed to look at that, and we hope that our report will try and give a view in that regard. We asked ourselves the question, do they really, really perform worse off than private firms? It's an area that we need to look into. And I think a mixed result comes out of that question. We sought to look at the question of whether, if these failures are existing and reform or transformation is necessary, how should it be accomplished? And those are some of the recommendations we will put in our report. We questioned ourselves around whether these SOEs could be reformed from within or are they so intrinsically inefficient that you need to import a doctor from somewhere to deal with them? And we will address those type of issues in our responses. We ask ourselves whether are changes only needed in the operating environment, or is there a need for a wholesale changes in a number of these areas? And also, we ask ourselves a key question to say the inefficiencies or the challenges that are being faced by SOEs, are they a byproduct of government required socio-economic objectives? And do the benefits for the social goals outweigh cost of efficiency? By and large, we sought through the review to really look at the role of SOEs in a developmental state. There are some critical observations that we started making based on the input that we get from the stakeholders. There are myriad strategy issues that are emerging. Overarching strategy for SOEs by the owners of this business, being government, is that saying there is a need, there is a void in that space, and it needs to be looked into. There appears to be poor alignment between SOE strategies and national objectives. If you look at some of the shareholder compacts and you look at the national imperatives of the country, in some areas there is a good match, in some areas there's a poor match. We believe that it is an area that requires to be addressed, and we hope that through the report we would be able to deal with it. In some instances, you can see that there's been quite a migration of mandates from the Founding Act to where they are today. And what is very clear is that there is a gap in terms of our strategy approach to have mandatory and structured reviews of these entities, so that at a given point you can actually start saying every 4 years, every 5 years, or every 2 years we would like to review to see whether there's still alignment in order to keep the strategy alive and dynamic. There are key issues around the definition of SOEs. Sitting around the table, we probably can all spell SOE, but what it means to us, it may mean a lot of other things. The issue of classification and categorization and the taxonomy of these SOEs becomes very, very critical, because it is when that is agreed upon that you can start talking about differentiated treatment of these entities in a form of how they are governed, how they are accounted, how they are owned, how they are funded. So it's a number, it results in a number of differentiated and yet very straightforward and clearly understood interventions by the government that owns them. There are issues around, I've touched on issues around, or I've come to the issues of legislation, regulation, and related aspects. There are gaps, there are duplications, there are conflicts, there's lack of clarity of mandates. In some areas, there are good regulations, in some areas, there are weak regulations. It is important that that area be looked into and that decisions be made. We have founding acts, we have MOUs, we have the Companies Act. Does the Companies Act, as it currently sits, protect the state of shareholders? The question that we need to answer. Some other countries are looking at dedicated SOE acts. Is it the way to go? We're reviewing and looking at whether we can make recommendations in that space. Issues of corporate governance, are observed as an area of focus. In that regard, some of the issues that are coming out relate to unclear distinction of roles of the shareholder, of the board executive, of the board, as well as executive management. The stance and texture of oversight, because it's sitting in various departments, is inconsistent. In some areas, one gets a sense that there's a very clear focus on how oversight should be conducted on these entities. In some areas, one has a sense that that consistency is probably not the best that it could be. We've also been informed of challenges around issues of remuneration, rewards, and performance-related issues. We observed in other countries that there is a much more structured approach towards dealing with frameworks for remuneration in SOEs. Some countries even legislate around that. We observe in our own countries to say in other areas there is better coordination. You go to the public service, you have the public service commission. You go to the public office bearers, there's a commission that is dealing with that. We ask ourselves the question whether there is a void in the space to create a platform for bringing in standardization and uniformity without impeding the capacity of SOEs to compete for the necessary skills, but creating a framework within which this type of issues could be looked into. The issue of establishment and disestablishment of SOEs, we also believe that it's a critical area to be further enhanced. The National Treasury has looked at some of those areas, and we believe that they've made some progress in that regard. But there seems to be challenges if you consider that, for instance, the establishment of entities in the municipalities is independent of the PFMA. The process of oversight ministries to ensure that they inform, you know, Treasury when they establish, when they disestablish, the prohibited forms of establishment where trusts, foundation, PPPs, and whatever are used as, you know, roundabout ways of avoiding the structured ways of establishment needs to be looked into so that the establishment process can be dealt with. We struggled because we are hoping to, as one of the deliverables, to hand in our report a database that has got at least 70 to 80% accuracy in terms of these entities, which is a little bit more enhanced, more than just listing and qualification of the nature of entity, but to talk a little bit more to see where is it, what does it do, what board does it have, what act does it have, that management information system to allow people a one source, a point of entry where they would be able to see what is existing. We could not find the type of platform, and this is why we took it as an opportunity also to just give it a start. It probably can be developed further. It will be part of the recommendations that we'll be looking into. Financial issues. I think there are a number of issues that have been raised by the stakeholders around these matters on the need for sustainable models, looking at the number of aspects that have been raised in the financial space. Then there are issues around performance that I've already alluded to. Alignment to government imperatives, very, very critical, because at this point in time, without a strategy, without a clear monitoring and evaluation process to ensure that some of the SOEs do what they're supposed to be doing, that alignment is being failed. Not because people don't want to, but the fact that there's need for better guidance in that process. Of course, in this whole process, we also looked for relevance of SOEs to take into account the fact that there are national strategic priorities as one has already put, political imperatives, social impact issues, creation of jobs, development of critical skills, quality and access of services, pricing, economic empowerment, and facilitation. Just yesterday, we had a session with a number of SCM executives, and they were saying, you know, sourcing is such an important role in SOEs, but and it's a new area where we should be developing new skills. Where do you get trained to become a buyer? To become
what's that then?
Your supply chain management. And it's very interesting. There's a voluntary association that they've set up for SOE procurement forum, where they've even advanced to start talking about it. They're working with SACWA to develop training levels and to look at how they can pick up learnerships to train young people on how to buy, how to source, and all that. So those are new emerging areas on how SOEs could be responding to some of these things, and it was quite intriguing to learn of some of the progress that is being made in some of these areas. The issue of skills is definitely screaming. I mean, we used to have very strong academies, and the big question at this point in time is whether the SOEs would have the capacity to revive those and play a role in the job creation aspirations that are being articulated by the state as their shareholder. We believe that there is quite a critical role that the SOEs can play, not just training for themselves, but also training for the economy of this country. And indeed, efforts have started, but those need to be advanced further. When we had an engagement with Minister Nzimande, he indicated that between himself and the Minister Mutsekga, they're doing a lot of work academically. But the uptake in terms of ensuring that these students that are educated and trained academically, the uptake to create experiential skills depends on business and as well as SOEs, and we believe they've got a critical role to play in those type of areas and in the various sectors. Issues of economic impact, what we're looking at is really to start saying, if you look at the strategies of these SOEs, are they supporting what the NGP is trying to drive? Are they supporting what IPEP is trying to drive and many other areas? And increased focus on environmental imperatives. We're trying to answer 21 key focus areas, which is our term of reference. We've clustered those into 4 key work streams: development and transformation, ownership and governance, business case and viability, strategic operational effectiveness. In the development and transformation, we're looking at those common understanding issues, classification, balance of socio-economic imperatives, sustainable human capital development, compliance with the transformation agenda of government. On the ownership front, we're looking at all those legislative and regulatory issues, accounting, reporting, and standardization of those aspects, the SOE database that I've spoken about, how do we recruit and select boards, and to ensure that they have the capacity to govern these entities, the board performance, and how those boards are remunerated. The business case would look at strategic importance and value creation, the funding options, the funding models, and how do we deal with PPPs? Does any entity wake up and structure their own the way they want, or should there be a framework dealing with those type of issues? Finally, the strategic operational effectiveness. You've established them. They have the strategies. They have the KPIs. Are they actually effectively delivering the service as they're supposed to be doing? The other key issue that came across, that is coming across, that we're looking into is the harmonization of performance measures, as well as the whole issue of collaboration, SOE to SOE, department to department, because at times it does come across as we talk to stakeholders that there's a lot of silo effect in terms of how these entity shareholders as well as the entities themselves are operating. We have collected amassed a lot of information. The challenge that we're facing now really is how we get out of the sea of information and be able to package it in a manner that it makes sense and it answers the questions that we have raised as we've put them there. We've been in touch with a lot of stakeholders. We've had round tables. We have had provincial engagements with the various entities and their leading ministries and all those. And I do want to say the information we have is a lot, and I do believe that it will contribute towards the quality of the recommendations that we shall be making. Just to hone into some of the high-level observations in terms of the energy sector, our observations really and the engagement, what the engagement informed us was that the energy entities are by and large, in our opinion, fragmented. We believe that it may be helpful to actually look into that space when you go into the micro-audit space, which we are not into right now, to look at whether there are ways in which to bring in a coordinated approach towards dealing with these entities. Because perhaps you could get more out of those in a coordinated fashion and even not only honing in terms of the texture and quality of oversight, honing in terms of harmonization and collaboration of effort. That's one area that seemed to come across as we were talking to some of the energy entities. The one other area that I didn't highlight is the whole issue of the country not having an approach that actually identifies in a deliberate and focused manner those sectors that are considered strategic. If I were to ask now to say which are the strategic sectors in which SOEs are operating, we have the strategic sectors in the NGP, in IPOT, but in some of the countries where we've been, if you go to Russia, they'll tell you that we have 5 strategic sectors, and this is how they've even legislated around those. To say in the strategic sectors we will be 100% shareholders, we will through legislation decide how we partner with other people and all that. If you go to China, you'll get about 15 strategic sectors. So it's important for the country, not by default, to identify those strategic sectors, and we consider energy to be one of those strategic sectors that are very, very important. Because I presume from the work that the input that we've been given was that the entities that you're having are working very hard to ensure security of supply of energy. The other area that we picked up as a key challenge is around funding, because if these entities have to do more work around this security of supply of energy, surely they need to be given air beneath their wings to be able to achieve the strategic objectives that they're supposed to be pushing. The issues of oversight are critical to start looking at the OECD would talk, for instance, about separation of function, and it's a debate that is all over the world. The issue of policy, regulation, and oversight, are they in the same place? Is there tampering with competitive neutrality if you are also regulating for the market? So those are the type of issues that should be debated within the sector to look at what's the best form of ownership that would inform the oversight versus the convoluted environment that may be interfering with this competitive neutrality. And again, on issues of ownership, it's the debate that is raging across all entities is there a case for a centralized platform for managing some of the strategic assets, or do we continue with a mixed model that we're currently having in the country of entities being managed under the shareholder ministries that they are currently sitting in, because we have a mixed approach. Some entities have been hived off to some form of centralized platform. Some entities are remaining in the policy ministries. then there is also a question of how do these energy entities work with the regions, if there is any, whatever. What's the role of regional entities? And is there a relationship between national and those regional entities? Those are some of the very high-level areas that comes to mind because I didn't, we didn't prepare in particular for the energy sector. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mama Stefan. You still had all the time in the West. But in any case, there it is. Can I allow time for questions from members? I must say this was a real high-level presentation, but of course you all have copies, you can refer to it. Honorable members.
Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Chair, you know, this is a very good report, but I didn't hear anything about job creation. Especially on the energy entities.
Okay. Denemlock.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think mine would be basically the comments. I mean, firstly, I do agree with Matiera on the areas that they have clearly delineated for attention. For a start, I think the critical point that shouldn't escape the Commission's attention is the issue of competitive neutrality. I think it's a very critical one. Do you want to have a situation where, I mean, I'll mix the examples. It's not that they apply in that manner. Do you ever want to have a situation where Transnet is regulated by Department of Transport, and Department of Transport is the one that determines the policy? I know it's not, that's not the arrangement, but I'm just giving that as an example. And in other departments, that's what's happening, where you find whether it's communication, there will be whatever, determining policy, but still regulating entities that are competing with private sector within certain areas. So I think that, for me, that's a critical area that needs to be looked into. The other second area that you have highlighted is around issues of corporate governance, the definition of roles and responsibility. And I think if we look at some of our past problems, recent problems, revolve around the issues of corporate governance, where the roles of the shareholder are not clearly defined, the role of the board is not clearly defined. You have a situation, let me cite examples. We have a situation where the board wants to appoint the CEO, but then the shareholder say, no, hold on, you can't appoint that CEO. We'll give you a CEO. But and you know, it violates the basic tenets of corporate governance. It's a problematic area because you have a CEO who then, in practice, can say, I don't report to Mr. The chairman and the board of this company, Company X. The minister is Mapiera. She appointed me, not the board. So the board can talk and say whatever it wants. But finally, I take my instruction from the person who appointed me. Especially if you have a situation where you get the minister who you say, okay, fine, I've appointed you, but you don't take instructions from me. My role ended up with the appointment, and therefore I don't even interact with you. That's the second issue, the interaction of the executive and the entity. If it's not clearly defined, and you find that me, as Mr. Mulotu, I'm the minister of this whatever department, I start to interact directly with Mr. Njigalani, who is the CEO, and I'm undermining the board. So those responsibilities have to be clarified. If, for instance, I mean, maybe I'm harping on this issue for too long, but I think that's part of our problem. If there's an agreement that indeed the appointment of the CEO will be done in concurrence with the executive, it's it's a different argument altogether. Then you can say there was consultation between the two entities, between the executive and the board, and they, in their deliberation, they came to the suitable candidate. And that becomes maybe a compromise arrangement which is better. Unlike where you have a board which is supposed to give a strategic direction to the company and hold the CEO accountable, but it can't appoint the CEO if the CEO is being imposed on the board. But I'm just citing that as one of the problematic areas in SOEs. The other issue that you have highlighted, and I'm glad that the Commission have put these matters in focus, is the issue of a clear communication from the shareholder to that entity about its objective. What does it want from this entity? Because some of them, like you have said, they have migrated from their mandate by default possibly to something else. Because sometimes the executive has not communicated its interest to that entity. I don't want to cite examples. I will just use fictional examples. You want a situation, okay, let's use a particular one then. You want a situation, for instance, with ESCO. The state has already said 70% will be done by ESCOM, 30 by IPPs. You know, and the question is, you don't seem to be seeing much progress. Or maybe, of late, there could be progress. So I think those are the things that you want to hold the board accountable. Say, this is the, and I think that was a clear definition of the interest of the shareholder. To say, this is what you want. And if the board doesn't perform, you deserve the board. You fire the board. And there's nothing wrong about that. To fire the board because the board has not fulfilled the mandate that you as the shareholder has communicated to. So I think, Chairperson, without taking much time, I think those are the areas where the shareholder need to communicate quite clearly to these entities and say, this is what, even on social economic indicators, let's use energy, because that's an example maybe we are familiar with here. You want to say to ESCOM, this is what we expect you to do in terms of rural areas. This is our rural development strategy, and we expect the following. You can't just tell us you are servicing the big, I'm not saying that's what they're doing. You can't just tell us you are servicing the big industrial customers and the metros, and the rural areas are falling by the wayside. This is the mandate that we are giving to you as the shareholder. I think if that type of communication is made to the SOEs, I think that would be helpful. Chairperson, I think I've said a mouthful. Maybe I'll come the next round. But lastly, just for the purpose of discussion, I would appreciate if Mathia can clearly define to us what does she mean by financial viability versus profitability, because I think that will help us in further discussion.
Thanks, Chair. There's very little I can say, actually. It's just to make an observation that the critical question here is this. The Commission is supposed to report. They are going to come back and tell us what they have decided to do about this situation. What I like, of course, is the problem statement elements. Many of those things are actually quite nice. I'm waiting to see how they respond to them, because that's really the challenge now. How do they address those issues? We have made inputs, in fact, talking on behalf of our party, as a stakeholder, we've made inputs. We have said certain things that we believe need to happen. So we can only wait and hear what they have done about those things. My critical question is this. Once the Commission has reported, they're going to present their report to the President, and the President obviously can decide to do what he pleases with it. My question is, how does the Commission see the process going forward? Because they're going to make certain recommendations. The President is going to take them, probably take them to Cabinet, then they decide whether they accept or reject or whatever. Is that process going to end there, or do they see it going back now to the stakeholders to engage them to say, you made inputs, we made decisions, the Cabinet has done this, these are the things that we believe need to be done,
what do you say? Or is it just going to be something that is going to end with the cabinet and say, now we've got the report from the commission, this is what they say. For example, they want to privatize ESCOM. Let's say they recommend that. Would it be something that will just go there, stay there, and the government comes up and says, oh, the commission has said, let's privatize ESCOM. We have agreed, let's privatize ESCOM. Or are they going to go back to the stakeholders and say, this is an issue, what do we do with it? Thank you.
Thanks, Jen. Just to comment regarding the security of supply issues, and I think the battle that we, the state entities, have to comply with that issue. Currently, we know that ESCOM, that the reserve margins are quite tight. And then, what you've mentioned, ma'am, is the funding problems. Of let's take an example to see that we get to the security of supply issues in terms of the capital expansion program of ESCOM. The huge problems in terms of funding these obligations that state-owned entities have to have more generation capacity, and the way these fundings are being done in terms of the models that currently, in terms of the financial models that we have there, and which impacts, of course, negatively on the consumer that has a 5-year 25% increase over 5 years. And then also the role of NERSA as an agency that has to overlook the price increases. And I'm sure you've taken that in consideration. And just your views regarding this, in terms of the compliance with the government's developmental agenda, like you said, which is also negative on job creation because it impacts on smaller businesses that would like to expand but has to pay a lot of energy costs. And I know it's a difficult equation to make. How do you balance these? The capital expansion program that's needed for security of supply issues, but also to see that we can get job creation on the lower level where businesses need the capital instead of higher tariffs, that they can actually apply their capital to have growth and expansion on their side, and that we have some serious job creation at the lower level. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm saying thanks for the presentation. I think it was very encouraging because you rightly say that 50% of the entities are not profitable. And that perception that we all have is that anything that is not profitable, it does not make a profit. And that's one of the things. I think if we had to look into this deeply and see how we can solve that problem, half the job that we have. The other thing is when we talk about creation of jobs and that, and then we give you an example of Russia and you say China, I don't think you're thinking about the labor situation, because if you talk about China, we know what the situation there, and you can manipulate, and you can. The situation is kind of different here, because here we believe in labor unions and we support them, and we are controlled by them. So it's one of the issues that we mustn't just look at China or Russia and say, oh, this what's happening there can happen here. So it's not. But there must be some sort of incentive for the people at the head of these issues, because. And there must be some sort of control. What hurts the community and the people is that when an entity runs at a loss and comes to government and asks for more funding, the big guys on top get huge bonuses, and that is what is disappointing. I think there should be some sort of control on that issue also. We know there's some. We know when we, from after 1994, there was organizations such as MOSGAS. MOSGAS every year came and got money from government. And then when there was a turnaround, they started making a profit. And I think that's a good example to say, how come for all those years there was a loss? And then when it turned, what turned it? If we can look and find out what happened there, I think we could be a way forward. Thank you.
that they throw in as well. I'd like to emphasize the issue of defining of viability. It's already been raised, but just to highlight that I'm one of the people who are actually concerned about that. How is it actually defined? You see, amongst other things, you find that history is littered with a number of state-owned entities which were established by governments. When through years, you know, through the practice or activities of non-viability, and at some stage, when they turned around, they got privatized, and they started thriving now in the private sector. And now the question is, had they started in the private sector with all those years, could it have been the same? You know, that I'm almost tempted to even name some of them, even in South Africa. So it's very important to look at how we define viability. In fact, I can dare say that one of the challenges we're facing in SAF, you know, when we start getting very harsh with SAF, SAF reminds us that, by the way, this is the mandate that we were given to handle all, you know, risky issues. Just a provocative question. How about disestablished entities? Did you run away from them simply because they are already disestablished? A question that comes to me is that it might be interesting to see why some of the entities were disestablished, unless some can view it as rather an academic exercise. I say it because at some stage I was part of the one of these entities, and it was quite an experience to see how it was you know, disestablished. Mampira, you kept on emphasizing on macro audit strategy. You obviously are triggering a question then. When will and how will the micro audit be done? I trust and hope as well that we'll have some time to allow the various entities to make an input who are here. But let's allow you to respond for now. But just as a comment, I see you did not touch on your current activities. I thought if I look at some of the slides, you were rather economic with time. It could be helpful just to indicate to us what you people are currently doing, unless I, through lack of concentration, I missed it. And that will definitely link with one of the questions as to where to from here.
Sure, I just want to apologize that I've been come on quickly to another venue for an urgent matter. So I'm not being disrespectful for this meeting and to Matiera. I have to sneak out quickly. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. You're released. Mapiacha, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Jay. The first issue that was raised is job creation. I did say that the relevance of SOEs should take into account critical social impact issues for the country, one of those being the creation of jobs, including the creation of critical skills, the quality and access of services, issues relating to pricing, issues relating to the transformation facilitation, you know, as embodied in the codified policy of transformation of this country. But let me pause a little bit and talk to this issue of job creation. We do believe that the role of SOEs in creating jobs is critical and core. When we look at the history of SOEs in this country, the information that we are dealing through informs us that it is one of the areas that have been effectively and efficiently used to create jobs. If you continue on reviewing literature and feedback that we get from stakeholders, one notes that at some point it appears the profit motive started almost being overbearing on these entities, to a point that, there has been a lot of rationalization in a number of them, probably for some good reasons, in some areas maybe questionable reasons. If you look at the issue of job creation, we really believe that the issue of doing so should be keenly looked into, and that cannot be divorced from the issue of developing specialist skills for these specialist sectors in which the SOEs are playing. The big question, as I've already indicated, most of them had very huge academies where they were growing their own timber in terms of these skills. Currently, efforts are being undertaken to try and revive that, but that process had actually almost been lost. Esplanade Park is no longer being used for what it used to be. You go to the Eskom Center, it's starting to get life. It was almost like a ghost town. And you ask yourself, how do we use those type of structures to assist us, really, in developing the skills that are very, very critical. I've just given such an example around SCM, supply chain management. They're new emerging skills and occupational categories. And I think SOEs should look into those, because if the shareholder, being the state, decides that they use these entities to intervene in the economy, it then becomes an innovative platform to even introduce new nature of jobs that go into these territories of driving economic development. So I do believe that they play a critical role. We've started hearing some of the stakeholders and the ministers talking about targets and numbers of new jobs that are going to be created by these entities, and it is an area that we'll also look into and make some input in that space. The government has raised a number of issues. The issue of competitive neutrality, the issue of separation of functions. Different views are being raised by stakeholders around whether indeed the whole issue of being a referee, a player, at the same time helps in terms of running these entities. You see those in a number of areas, whether in the water sector, whether in the transport or whatever. So it's an area that we need to look into to start saying there is a very clear role of policy ministries. They must develop policy for everybody. It doesn't have to be policy for SOEs, but it's for everybody who plays in that sector, and they must ensure that that policy is adhered to, and in a disciplined fashion, it is rolled out for the purpose for which it is established. Then there's a whole issue of regulating. Should regulation be independent? And there's a whole host of debate. Some of the people are saying no. Some of the sectors, you can keep regulation within the policy ministry, or you can make it independent and make it allied to the policy ministry that it is responsible for. It's a huge debate. Indeed, the question that has been raised to say, if you are a minister of transport and you are having aviation within your portfolio and your within you having AXA that may be doing certain things and you're having SAA within your portfolio, the market will cry foul in terms of competitive neutrality. So we are seeking, this is why we said the whole issue of separation of functions that is being spoken about, we need to talk about Kimberley and debate more profusely to start saying going forward when we talk about the ownership arrangement and the oversight arrangement, where does this situation put us in terms of positioning SOEs going forward? Corporate governance issues are very, very key, and they are also linked to the enabling environment that one referred to earlier on. But what is core in this whole issue of corporate governance is bold shareholding by the state as the owner of the businesses. Because if that bold shareholding is clear, it will inform how these entities are owned, it will inform how these entities are managed, it will inform how these entities should be governed, it will inform how the enabling environment should be structured to ensure that they do what they're supposed to be doing. And I think in the absence of that, you would always find this vacuum in terms of who does what, who doesn't do what. And I'll give an example of a number of countries that we've looked into. If you go to Malaysia or you go to Singapore, Namibia have also moved into the space to start saying this is how we will boldly own our entities. They've developed a legislation, an SOE legislation, that actually informs them how, as a shareholder, they are going to own, they are going to govern, they are going to demand performance from the various entities. And it's developing. You know, you can see that they are straddling the good aspects of their Companies Act and their new legislation that they've set up. They've set up structures where they're bringing in strategic ministers to say, this is the oversight committee that will assist us, you know, to decide on how to deal with the diverse issues that we want to deal with in this area. And it's a number of examples that we've looked into. You go to France, they have an agency, APE, that is looking into the entities that they're managing and all that. And they have developed a framework, you know, boldly to say, as a shareholder, this is how we would like to deal with it. You go to Norway, you would find that they have their own structure in terms of how that needs to be done. And what is going to inform effective corporate governance is not the loose ad hoc pieces of approach. It's that bold shareholding approach, and that will inform the strategy for SOEs, the bold shareholding approach, that should inform how things should happen. And that will clarify the roles. Indeed, the roles should be clarified. How do you deal with appointment of SOEs? Is it in concurrence with, or is it the board that is appointing? I mean, APE, for instance, I'll give again France as an example, they would say, yes, you can identify, interview, whatever, but to appoint is in concurrence with. You go to Norway, they would say, yes, in concurrence with. You go to Poland, they'll say, in concurrence with. In some areas, they will tell you that the government appoints. In some areas, they'll say, those things should be clear, upfront, and common across all SOEs. We shouldn't have different approaches that are not commonly informed in terms of what is happening. And that links also to the legislation. Currently, if you look at the protection of shareholding, the state as a shareholder by the Companies Act, the feedback we're getting in some of the stakeholders is that the government as shareholder is not sufficiently protected by the Companies Act. So one would have to look at that to say, I mean, DPE is actually saying there are certain areas of the Companies Act that may require to be strengthened to allow this shareholding by government, to allow them to be able to ensure that those clear roles are very, very, you know, outwardly spoken to. The board, you know, the Companies Act requires that the board focus on the effectiveness of the business, the relationship between the board and the shareholder needs to be clarified also to ensure that it's strengthened, that that flow actually does what it's supposed to be doing. Clear communication, remandate, you cannot do it otherwise. And I think the example that we've been given by the technology to start saying, we told ESCOM that 70-30 in terms of IPPs and whatever, those type of indicators are very, very critical. You know, you come to entities where they are saying, you know, we haven't signed a shareholder compact in the last 4 years. And we ask, how are you operating? You know, and that becomes a very serious challenge to start saying, if you are a board shareholder, a shareholder that gives direction, a shareholder that gives guidance, a shareholder that determines the outputs that you are looking for, then that should happen. You meet entities that would say, look, we submit quarterly reports, but there is no response to our quarterly response. We don't even have an engagement with the shareholder ministry. The oversight entities are at different levels of consistency. Some of them are strong oversight entities that are able to really engage with the entities. Some of them are just non-existent. Those reports are just going in the written output. So those type of issues need to be very, very clear. You raised an issue, honorable member, around some of the entities not being profitable. It's not us saying that. It was a report that was issued by Race Relations at the end of this, sometime last week, to say 50% of the entities are not profitable. And there was a debate around that, to say, what do you use as a criteria for performance? One of the economists came on radio, and he was actually saying, how do you say ESCOM hasn't performed at this point in time? You know, how do you deal with this notion of them being non-profitable? But at the same time, you're aware that they are rolling out a massive infrastructure rollout to ready the country for effective economic participation. But if those imperatives were clearly defined, one would understand that probably in the next 3 years or so, they may not put, you know, financial profits forward, but at the same time, you would see massive benefits in terms of their reach into rural areas, massive benefits in terms of their rollout of the infrastructure program. But those things are determined by the person who owns the entities. And to say, I understand why they are performing the way they are performing at this point in time. And that would bring us also to the issue of viability versus profitability. I think what is important, you know, when we talk about viability, we are saying when an entity is viable, it is bringing minimal burden or less burden to the fiscus. Because you're saying, I've established you, I don't want to be worrying about, you know, the burden of how you finance your operations and all that. Because I've given you sufficient startup, be viable. Be able to finance yourself, be able to do other things. But at the same time, here are my predetermined socioeconomic imperatives that I want you to drive. So show me that you have the capacity to do that. The profitability aspect, you know, I mean, and again, it's not a misnomer. If your view is to say, I've invested in a telecom and I'm looking for a dividend and a good dividend, again, your approach would be clearly articulated. You'd be looking for all those. But the bottom line is that I think any shareholder who has classified these entities to say these are the public entities where I'm looking at giving a grant. I mean, the Netherlands people would say in terms of their Prater-like entity, they are saying we've told them that we don't ask anything from them. We give them 2.3 billion a year. What we want from them is efficient trains, clean trains, safe and secure trains, and the public should tell us that they are doing what they are supposed to be doing. They are effective and efficient. But when you look at on the other side and you start saying this is a public entity that is, you know, financed by a state grant, this is what you are expecting from them. And then on the other one, you are saying, look, you have all the elements to reduce your burden on my pet. So I think that's where we start talking about viability. You go to some to Norway, they would say to what do they call it? Avinor. They would say to Avinor, you have five 50 airports that are very profitable, and you have 47 that are non-profitable. We allow you to cross-subsidize, but we also look for this level of dividend. It's those definitions by the shareholder that are very, very critical and important. Mr. Mchau, you did say the whole issue of how we're going to respond to the problem statement. We hope that our report will be able to give some answers to some of those issues that are raised as problem statements. You asked a question around the report, how it will be handled. Currently, our remit really is to look into the terms of reference that has been allocated, respond to them, give the report to the president. Should there be a life beyond that, that is not our calling. The president will advise on the way forward on that report. Yeah. The issue of funding obligations and the negative impact on the consumer, indeed. I think those are some of the areas that will talk to the funding models, to the approaches, and the proposals that we get from various stakeholders, because there are quite a volume of suggestions on some of the permutations that could be looked into in terms of efficient funding of or accommodatable funding of a number of these initiatives that are being taken into account. I've answered you on the issue of profitability, the labor situation. You mentioned the issue of China. I referred to China and Russia purely on the issue of strategic sectors. I did not talk about them in relation to the labor situation. We were saying what we have seen working well, as well as in countries such as Malaysia and Brazil. It's the whole isolation of sectors that they consider strategic and how these SOEs play in those strategic sectors. The issue of remuneration, incentives, and performance, I think it is critical for the shareholder to look at that one, to bring a harmonized approach, and it is not a new area in this country. The public service has dealt with that. The office of what we call it, the public office data space has a commission, and we have seen in other countries, you know, it's a very, very clear area that is under management, under control, and the WPEG, for instance, the framework or the salaries just below market, because they compete in the same place with the market for those best skills. But it is an area where a framework and a structure is required to ensure that you can have harmonization, you can deal with the salary difference, you know, the remuneration differential ratios there, and ensure that as a shareholder you feel comfortable that it is doing, you know, the remuneration is conducted in a manner that allows you to feel comfortable that you can still get good skills, you can retain, you can support the economy of the country, and at the same time you are not paying, you know, very differentiated salaries based on nothing. And definitely those should be linked to performance management. You cannot divorce those two. The disestablishment of entities, Chair, I think it's an area that needs to be looked into, because currently there is a process via the PFMA that talks about how we establish, how we disestablish. But our preliminary observations are telling us that there is some level of advocacy in some of these areas. And this is why we started linking this with a process that says, our observation is that if you take, for instance, countries such as New Zealand, when they set up an agency, in the Founding Act, they would say this entity is established at point X, whether it's 10 years, whether it's 8 years, the entity must come back to give an account of how they have, executed the mandate, the reason for why they should still exist. Countries such as Norway, every 4 years they issue a white paper on all their entities to say these are the entities, this is where they are, these are the ones that are being graduated into the open market, these are new entities that are proposed to be coming in. So there is a structured process of actually periodically reviewing the mandates of entities. So it doesn't become somebody else just sitting in a dark corner deciding when to establish, when to disestablish. Once you've established, there is an open and transparent process of why you exist, why you should exist, and justifying the existence or non-existence of an entity. And we believe it would be a good practice to consider probably going forward in this country. And that will deal with the advocacy, that will deal with some of the sentiments that you were raising to say, you know, it left some question mark for you in terms of some disestablishment of some of the entities. It will deal with, it will introduce a lot of transparency and structure in terms of why we establish, why we disestablish, some of these entities. Around the issue of the micro-audit, I think it is clear to us and also the stakeholders that have been participating that there is so much to be done. But, you actually would need a phased process of actually dealing with the magnitude of the intervention that needs to be put in place. The macro analysis should at least get the fundamentals right. What's the strategy? What's the enabling framework? What's the performance and rollout aspects that need to be looked into? What are the immediate capacity issues that needs to be looked into? We believe that a macro audit may be necessary, particularly within the various sectors. If you take energy, you'd be having to look at those areas to start saying, given this micro analysis and the macro recommendations that are given, what does it mean in terms of our sector to create an enabling environment, to narrow, to bring those things to align, to mitigate the silos that are existing. So I think we believe that that's another phase of the process that would need to be looked into, and we would make recommendations also in terms of our view of how the macro audit process could be looked into. So there would be a whole phased approach in terms of the recommendations that we would be making to the president. You asked a question around our current activities. I have said that we're almost sitting at 80% of our information and engagement process. We are now right at the middle of overwriting, amending, factoring in new things, and we also are busy with some roundtables, testing and engaging stakeholders around some of the emerging issues and hearing them out around those type of issues, the uniform generic type of emerging issues. But effectively, we're writing and we're hoping that we can close this exercise by the end of March and give the report to the president and allow him to comment, and then we can finalize everything.
Any other round? Oh, just before that, can you take a break? We've been at it for us for some time. Just a 10-minute break.
I'm doing here. Manje abanye calling to say I content. What was the reason for this? Don't know, I wasn't there.
Yeah. They came looking on my door as well. Mm. But the SFF made all that they ran.
Look at compliments to you, my dear. I'm okay, I'm good. But in the oil that they ran.
Yeah.
I'm not good. There's no seat there. There's no seat there. What's his name is covering you?
What happened there before?
No, but if I can tell him about it, what happened here? Over here. So she's trying to organize something for February. You're saying end of February?
Mm-hmm. Because I remember one day they approached February and the other day said, fine, tell us when.
And then we did all these 17, and right now we need to watch the event in March.
I was the engine refining, but I
between Cape Town and Joburg and Pretoria, so it doesn't seem to make sense to move. So I'll sit in the middle.
Yeah. No, I mean, Durban is a nice pop.
Yeah.
How far is it from here? 2 hours?
Yeah, still a long
way. Same as for us.
Yeah.
talk about on land
given quite helpful. Let me give the members another round if they would like to make further input. I'm also doing this with the understanding that this was an initial phase of a lifetime process. Of course, Wampiecha has already indicated that they are about 80% towards completion of this current phase. I'm sure we'll all agree that after the MPs have made input, it would be also appropriate to allow the department as well as the entities just to make some comments here and there. Honourable Member, Kadelu.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm very happy with today because I've been empowered. The information has been very good. Say for instance you have an SAE, an entity going, and you are developing and you are progressing, and you want to extend this entity. Is it possible for you to go outside the government and get funds in order to enlarge it or do whatever you want? You need more money. Government has got more money to give, but you want to go get a loan from outside. will there be such a mechanism that can be used?
Is that all? Okay, if you could just respond to that question.
Chair, I am going to try and deal with this in two parts. I've mentioned the whole issue of classification and categorization of entities around 2013. So it was an exercise that was undertaken by DPSA and Treasury to look at the whole agentification process. And as one spoke of this 900 or so entities, it becomes an imperative for the shareholder to actually concretize the categorization and classification of these entities. Are they public sector entities? Because if they are public sector entities and you look at the funding arrangement, most of those would be highly reliant on the grants that they get from the state. If you take an entity like PRASA and start talking about viability and profitability issues, it almost becomes a misnomer, because plus minus 80% of their funding comes from a grant that they get from the state, and there is a level of commerciality where they have revenues and whatever, 20 to 30% or so. If you are having an entity such as that one, then to respond to a question that you're raising, you'd be saying, if they are to get any resources outside the fiscus, the shareholder would have to play a very critical role there to start saying how should these entities be further supported to grow and expand what they are doing. When you start talking about government business enterprises, the Companies Act will talk about SOCs, which are state-owned companies. There will be a further classification probably that talks about SICs, which are state-owned company in which the state has interest and maybe doesn't necessarily own a significant portion of that, but is looking more for returns in terms of dividends and that type of thing. And you find that type of arrangement largely in companies that, for instance, IDC invests in and all that type of thing. Then you would also have in the government business enterprises probably the DFIs. In that category, surely you're starting to talk about very strong balance sheets that can probably go to the market. But again, I don't believe that the entities would just willy-nilly go there. There would have to be certain arrangements and agreements with the shareholder to say, in such circumstances, what then do you do? And this is where the whole issue around financing models, and I'm sure the entities that are here would talk to the financing models, what's the framework of getting into these PPVs and those type of arrangements. Having given this whole long litany, at the end of it all, is an owner of these businesses, and there must be a framework within which that type of exercise can be done, if advocacy is to be dealt with, if alignment with an overarching strategy for these SOEs is to be achieved, if alignment with support for the national developmental goals is to be achieved, because at the end of the day, if there is a default, there is somebody else who owns this entity who will carry the burden of ensuring that those funds are paid. I hope it's a very long-winded answer, but I hope it does cover something.
Thank you very much. I think it's an opportunity now for entities to make comments. More than anything, I don't want to straight target you, but it would be nice just to have a sense as well that in your earlier interactions, as well as up to now, given the recent today's revelations, do you have a sense that the areas that are covered, just the areas that have been covered, are adequate enough such that you have confidence on the outcome, that you will be able to address challenges that you have been through, but also it will create a good platform that even in future, good things that you have done can even be improved. That is reinforcement that maybe development and transformation, ownership and government, business cases, that is viability, strategic and operational effectiveness, and all the detailed work streams that are contained therein. That's adequate for as far as you are concerned. If that's my question, which I would like each and every entity just to indicate, you know. Of course, informed by its own territory and competency. Ladies and gentlemen, the floor is yours. Oh, just before that, because we created a precedent and had everyone who was here to be known to everyone. But we will not do this, you know, all the time. Because in future we will not have them. Can you introduce yourself, Numza? Can you use?
I'm Riaz. I'm a non-executive director of the Central Energy Fund.
Okay, thank you. Who else, Sisi?
I'm from
Petra. Oh, Petra is out in full force, of course. And also Ndegera Throka from Chevron. Oh, welcome. Okay. Don't look otherwise. That shoot up. Any comments, any inputs, any questions?
My name is Busima Buza from CEF, non-executive director. Chair, just...
welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. Chair, two comments from my side. The first one, was a question from the honorable member about whether we believe we can leverage financing from outside our own entities and government. Of course, the path of least resistance for funders is to say if your project is attractive enough, they will say yes, we will give you the funding, but if you give us a government guarantee of some sort. However, I believe that even in the absence of government guarantees, if our business case is sufficiently compelling, then we would be able to raise funding from the outside. In terms of our own history as the CEF group, we have raised external funding in the past, but of course have had the support of a rather sizable balance sheet to back us up. We hope that going forward, as we enter in probably high investment phase, that we will still get the support of external funders for our projects. So the other issue in just acknowledging the Presidential Review Committee's work and the outcomes thereof and the interaction that they've had with us, which has assisted us as well quite a great deal in terms of the probing questions that they've asked us. In acknowledging their work, Chair, if I may just offer a comment from our experience in terms of our reporting lines. The CF group at the moment reports to the policy department, or report to the Department of Energy. That has been, in terms of our experience to date, very beneficial because it allows us to stay close to the mandate issues that we have. So we're not necessarily a purely commercial entity. We're an entity whose primary responsibility deals with the security of supply issues. And we have benefited a great deal from being as close as we are to the policy department. I hope that the administrative burden that we may have put on the department has not been so high that they would hold a view that we should be placed elsewhere. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Now Sibusi has kicked the ball. Surely there could be other comments. Nothing. Oh, Kalaze.
Thank you, Chair. I think we also need just to join the callers in appreciating the comprehensive, high-level articulation of the Presidential Review Committee's observations on the review of state-owned entities. I think one observation that is well made from our perspective is one relating to the fragmented nature of the state-owned entities and the various species of legislative frameworks that perhaps may not even be speaking to each other, and also talking to the overlapping and duplicated mandate, because it is an area that, from where we're sitting as a regulator, we are concerned about, particularly in view of a number of international obligations that also arise from the mandate that we're supposed to pursue on behalf of the Republic. And when you look at what is happening in other areas that are impacted upon by the same regime of international conventions, etc., you find that that fragmentation is really not in the best interest of the Republic, and therefore might also compromise and jeopardize some of the issues that relate even to nuclear security interests, which have got broader ramifications when you look at them. So I do want to appreciate that observation and wish that the Commission could drill a little bit deeper as it seeks mechanisms as to how to harmonize and ensure that those issues are actually highlighted and elevated to the platform that they deserve. And also, it just for the Commission to also bear in mind the international obligations, as I've indicated, and how we coordinate as the regulatory structures in this particular area. And which leads me to the small question, really, that I would like to pose to the Commission, and it is there going to be some rank ordering in terms of the level of significance that is attached based on deployment of resources and or attention to commercially inclined state-owned entities vis-a-vis regulatory inclined kind of entities, because that might also have an impact in terms of what eventually makes its way into the recommendation and how these are dealt with, and so that we do not have things that fall into the cracks. There has been a lot of emphasis on the commercially inclined state entities in the discourse today, and I'm not too sure that that perhaps might not somehow disadvantage those that are not commercially inclined in terms of the focus and the recommendations that need to emanate from there. That would be just my short input. Thanks, Chair.
Advocate Boisim Kize from the National Nuclear Regulator. Again, see, Mam Piecha, you're wondering who's coming with such hard questions. I see. No, I know. Okay, that's fine. I think Kamandela is triggering this question because of the sensitivity around the nuclear regulation. And also, I mean, I don't want to preempt the report, but it's quite an interesting thing because we deal with nuclear energy here, whereas there's nuclear technology as a broader environment. And I mean, it's been a year now since I've been fully in this seat, and I haven't heard us actually interacting and working out how these two worlds are linked. In fact, in terms of technology, nuclear energy is supposed to be a subset of, you know, the whole regime of nuclear technology. Of course, at some stage we'll be looking at those things. The Sanedi experience is just one good example of why you should be, you know, at some stage seized with that. I like rank ordering. Rank ordering. I'm sure honorable members know why Advocate Skiza is coming with that. He's been with us a couple of times. Well, let's hope now that the speaker has sent our report to DOE to engage with the National Treasury. No, Mamsum, I'm not putting it on your shoulder, guys. You don't hold the purse, it's National Treasury. But Ndatamtau, this once again reinforces what you have raised. That one might even boldly say that it just doesn't get confined to the department itself, but also to even if the relevant SOEs. Any other input? Okay, no other input. Let me then talk. I did not mark afterthoughts, but now I've discovered them in my notes. Let me raise them. One, the history of academies. You write the ESCOM Academy in Midrand, as well as the Esalen Park and the rest of others. In fact, I've met people within the ESCOM world who are, you know, who have a gripe, if I can use this language, you know, who are very frustrated, you know, that people who are in the belly of the beast, very frustrated about why and how ESCOM downgraded or reduced its training capacity. In fact, I'm guilty if I did not pass that information to ESCOM, because that I asked that gentleman to actually give me a written email so that I could, you know, pass it to ESCOM, because he was giving me factual information about that. Now, let's look at it globally. In a sense, why were those academies closed or downgraded? Just a very naive question. Of course, it's going to trigger a litany of things out of it, but I think that could be a good step. Why were they? And I'm sure the gentleman there, the second, that is a sugar, would also link it with what we were discussing, one of the members last week. The whole challenge of skilling, it comes up again. But in a more sensitive way now, because we're talking of state-owned entities who were supposed to have championed and maintained that momentum, and even improved it in any case, particularly in the current political dispensation. So bear with me, my question is actually strongly political influence. One other thing I'm going to ask is the thing that we have made comparative start at a global level. Did you pick up any angle as to the extent to which political systems, different political systems, influence the establishment
and the policy frameworks and regulatory and legal frameworks of SOEs. I mean, let's be clear, you wouldn't expect SOEs in Cuba and Vietnam to be established on the same lines like in US or Europe. Even to an extent, there would be a variance in the Scandinavians who are historically social democrats. And how about the Middle East? You know, particularly countries which are not secular, which are strongly Islam-based. Doesn't that have some influence? You know, or look, if you didn't pick that up, I might as well turn it around and say, look, please, even if you're at 80%, take a look at it because it's very important. What if it can actually reveal something that you didn't pick up before? I think the others are. Well, let me just throw everything because we're moving, we're tapering towards closure now. You must, at some stage, you mentioned funding models, and I can see even here under the business cases, you said viability and funding. I mean, personally, I would really be very, very firm about that. That not only should you say funding, to me, it should be saying resourcing models, particularly funding, because funds, money, is just one of the resources that's necessary. We've just made reference to human resources and skilled human resources for that matter. I think that's one thing that should be highlighted and articulated one way or another. And I have confidence that, as you said, you have collected a lot of data within those tons and tons of or gigabytes of information, you would find quite a lot of information around that. I know from my previous world in trade and industry, we had a raging debate about how funding models for the FDIs, your IDCs, NEFs, and you know, SAMAFs should be refunded because we really wanted them to advance on the good work that they already done. Sorry, I'm using that as just a direct experience and I'll illustrate where I come from. The identification of strategic sectors, I do see that some time. Excuse me, honorable members, if I'm unnecessarily repeating that, but it's very important. Because amongst other things, even ourselves as the energy sector, we're not an apex committee, we're not an apex sector, but what I sense, I hope facts will corroborate, is that it is beginning to emerge that energy should be regarded as a strategic sector. And that's a debate that should rage from now henceforth. We bring facts on the table on that matter. Of course, from various angles, you know, whether you look at it from a social transformation or economic transformation, even from political perspective. I thought the SOEs would say something about fragmentation, overlapping, because it's one of the, you know, most serious leprosies that in quite a number of cases compromises the effectiveness of the government's service delivery on the whole. Remember, at the end of the day, you want to see a community, a government doing, even if it has this complex, you know, machinery, but it must have a cumulative effect, better life for everyone. I mean, the fact me as an ordinary person wants that often on the overall, but then it means this machinery must work as a whole. And what was raised that that the entities are fragmented. Of course, that was just a highlight on the energy entities, but not only here, but I know in the other areas as well. And I really expected that entities would actually just corroborate that and indicate their keenness to see that we get rid of it sooner than later. Last but not least, to what extent is there any orientation? I'm throwing this honorable members to you and everyone. Is there any orientation to encourage institutions of learning and training, the research as well, to actually take up the concept and move with it? Because what the presidency has done through this committee is just to open a drum of worms, not a tin of worms. Because once you move into the micro audit arena, then no matter how much bucks we can have as a government, it still would have its limitations. That's sort of what triggered this question to me. Because I, sitting in the portfolio committee for health, would be keen that also we have a micro audit of our own entities in health sector, isn't it? I, sitting in COCTA, or Department of Local Government, Cooperative Government, would like to see all those entities, you know. And then the question, where does it start, where does it end? You know, because already the committee, as it is, has done its best to look at things at macro level. It may not be the only answer, but I like provoking. I come from that word, as I say. I'm just presenting it to that in that from that perspective. That to what extent would there be any encouragement, or has there been any thought of that? You know, can that be handled, or would that be part of the forward thinking, and whatever? I'm sure you've got a handful now to respond to.
Let me start where Mema Abuza just the comments that she made. Indeed, I'd like to thank this sector, not only for participating, but also for the support. We did get some level of support in terms of warm bodies to assist us in mining some of the information that we're sitting with, and for that we would like to thank them. You know, in front of everybody here to say, you know, they did come to the party in a big, big, big way. When we were searching for information, they were never stingy with the information and sharing with us their documents, and that was truly very, very helpful. And I think the same goes for the regulatory space. We did get people reaching out to you in Tatemkize, and thank you for that. The fragmented nature of SOEs that we're talking about and the legislative conflict is definitely an issue to be addressed. And I think we would be looking at, we'll be having a round table in 2 weeks' time, just looking at a number of those issues that came out of this mining of information in the space of the legislative conflicts that are existing. There were investigations that were made through the Department of Public Enterprises. We were working with DTI on the process that they had in developing the Companies Act. We also requested some experts just to do a very broad analysis of these clashes and these conflicts in terms of legislation, and to look at some of the processes that we could engage. We've looked, for instance, at the Namibian exercise, where they have looked at an effort to try and consolidate the legislative approach to SOEs. So we will be sitting around the table just to have a dialogue around those type of issues, to have a sense of direction and a sense of input around those type of aspects that deals with legislative conflict. And it is a very, very critical area
that we need to look into. That, in a way, also talks to, I think, the whole issue of classification and categorization of entities becomes very, very critical. And one of the examples that we were discussing just a week ago is to look at service agencies, you know, that are categorized the same, but are treated very differently. You have, for instance, SARS, CETA, and SASA. They are entities that are categorized the same. They are service agencies. They are doing mega work for government. You look at the positioning of SARS in terms of how, for instance, if I may just choose one indicator, they all do not, you know, CETA has a board, SARS doesn't have a board, SASA doesn't have a board. And they are all categorized under public entities. They are service delivery entities. I think there are three Bs. Yeah, they are all three Bs. One has a board, two doesn't have board, and for very strategic reasons when you engage with the entities and talk to them. But again, you start seeing that the lack of consistency in how we treat this type of things is one, the remuneration practices with SARS, it's almost, you know, market-oriented. With CETA, it's market-oriented. With SASA, irrespective of the fact that they are handling something like 106 billion of the state, because you give them about, what, 97 billion to distribute and 6 billion to operate that distribution. The remuneration is pegged to public service and giving them mega resources to deal with, and you want to check whether, from a capacity point of view, are you talking about a consistent platform, because that is also equally very important. They need to make sure that enough funds are being mobilized and secured for the budget of the state. You look at CETA, they handle mega infrastructure rollout in terms of technology and IT. SASA is handling you lower end in terms of, you know, the whole grant, whatever. But the budgets are almost sitting on the same, whatever. And then you start asking yourself as an observer to say, what informs this approach and not that one? So the categorization becomes and classification becomes critical, because it then informs how you finance the operations, how you govern, how you do particular things. But I'm bringing that to show the conflict, to show the discord, and to start saying that strategy is critical to inform how things go forward. The issue you're raising, Mr. Jomke, is around rank ordering. I would respond to it in a very maybe long-winded way. Or rounded way. Capacity that we spoke about is very critical. The capacity to own, the capacity to govern, the capacity to execute. And the regulator is a very important element of the capacity. Because if you're looking for a vibrant economy, that is two-winged, because this whole developmental state hinges on a strong private sector and a strong public sector intervention. And that's where the role of regulation becomes very, very critical. Our observations and the feedback we are getting from the stakeholders and from the research that is being done is that the rank ordering would be too much of a luxury. You can't rank order. You actually need to ensure that the resourcing that the chair is talking about is available to ensure that you inject the necessary vibrance in the economic market. So regulation is very, very critical, and ensuring that it is well-resourced becomes a responsibility to drive capacity in this whole sector of SOEs. So I don't think we would be looking at rank ordering. If one talks about
the distribution of the resources. What we have learned from countries such as Namibia, they are saying, they, for instance, when they deal with issues of infrastructure, if you have a strategy and you have priorities, then you actually start looking at the basket to say this basket has to talk to those priorities and the strategy that we've set up. They have a committee that is chaired, I think, by the president. I don't know whether it's the president or, the head of cabinet. And then there are strategic ministries where they actually sit to say, if these are our priorities, these are our, and so if this is what we're doing, this is how we cut this cake for our infrastructure development and all that. We believe that that type of focus and deliberate approach would be helpful in some of these issues. But the rank ordering is not what we're thinking of. Regulation is a very critical priority in this to drive a competitive neutrality and to ensure that the country continues to create a platform for participation by foreign direct investors, by the private sector that is here, and the role that your entities are playing is becoming is very, very critical. The history of academies, Chair, that you raised, and to say what happened. Whilst we can't say there is a similar thing, but what we seem to be observing, what we're being informed is that when the profitability drive started dominating our SOEs, all those structural arrangement pressures started knocking at the doors of a number of these entities, the softer areas of the entities we looked into, because people wanted to look good, people wanted to look profitable, and again, the whole debate around viability and profitability then becomes very, very imperative to start saying, and also the issue of clear definition of those predetermined objectives by the shareholder to say, over and above doing this, this is also what I'm looking for in terms of your output. And I think that's where we are sensing, and we're getting the feedback that that profitability drive, the singular profitability drive where everybody, even smaller entities like AMSCO, would talk in their boardrooms, in their executives to say we're not profitable. I don't know how they become profitable because 100% of their grant comes from the state and their work is to buy for the defense ministry. So that drive, that orientation, somewhat bedeviled some of these areas. And a non-vocal and a non-resolute shareholder who would say, I did not see when Bu Memabuza comes here to come and present to you, it should be, I think it should be a very, very strong demand from them to say, how many jobs did you create? By the way, what else did you do? What else did you do in the academies? How many students have done whatever. So it becomes a very obvious demand by the shareholder to say there are certain predetermined objectives. When I say you've performed, that is when this has happened and that has happened, and the balance is very clear and is known to everybody. I think somehow there has been a downplaying of the articulation of some of those expectations, and it became almost by default a way of avoiding some of the type of areas. Currently, the focus is quite vocal, and it appears more and more of the entities are starting to redevelop those academies. There's need to scale up, there's need to give more impetus, and that will depend on the strong voice from the owners of these entities.
The strong voice.
Yeah. You asked a question around the issues of political systems. We didn't quite go into that directly, but the research and the engagement does seem to talk to, I mean, when you talk about being a developmental state, there is almost some political nuance that sits behind that to say where is this direction going. It is not these entities that decide that we're a developmental were driving a developmental agenda as entities. They draw it from a government which is influenced by whatever, but I think what we will do, we'll mark it so that our report can almost, we can look at that research and see what it is bringing out, because some of the entities, you know, we looked at countries which have attempted to deal with this agenda of a developmental state. Some were non-democratic, some were democratic, so you see those political overtures. I think we will, in that chapter, try and deal with what has been observed around the political systems and how they influence the thinking around this matter. I agree with you, Chair, when you say it's not just about financial models, it's more the resourcing models, and it's got to look at a broad side of elements. We have had engagement with some of the, you know, for instance, the Minister of Public Enterprises, who's saying, when we look at some of these models, let me take an example such as PPPs. Does the CEF just go and decide that this is how we will structure our PPPs, and tomorrow the Limpopo Development Corporation decides to go into a PPP and they structure it the way they want it? Or should the shareholder be saying, we agree that PPPs are one of the ways in which we can raise resources to run our entities, but we would do it within this type of framework? So it's those type of things that, you know, the Minister of Public Enterprises was saying, it's the debate that should take place. Shareholders should debate those type of issues and create a framework within which to execute some of those opportunities. So I think there are a number of issues that are coming out of there, and we've had quite some engagement with Treasury around the their thinking in some of these matters, and we will highlight some of the feedback that we have received. The strategic sectors, we can almost say similarly, is a very important exercise. There are strategic sectors that seem to be emerging: transport, energy, communications, water, finance, but somehow we feel the shareholder should be saying, now that they are by default emerging, are these the only ones, are the new ones that we're looking into, given where we are going? We've heard of pharmaceuticals, we've heard of mining. Where does it sit within this group of strategic sectors? Because then you can almost start aligning to say, do we need new entities, or do we take these strategic sectors and match them with some of the existing entities so that they can be driven in a structure, in a very focused manner. There is fragmentation and overlapping very clearly. You talk to DOC, you talk to DPSA, and the question is, isn't CETA about communication technology and whatever, where does it sit vis-a-vis DOC remit of doing things? So it's a lot of questions around issues of overlapping and where some of the oversight aspects are sitting, and that's where the micro audit will have to go in to start saying, yeah, Centec, and then you have broadband Infraco, should they be separate, are they together? Those discussions must take place when now you go into the micro audit space to start saying, do we need the 590 as it is, or do we need to be narrowing and having fewer, but well structured and well extended and to assist us to do certain things. So I think those in the next phase of micro auditing and alignment and narrowing would have to take place. The review that I know that we're talking about, the involvement of institutions of higher learning into the space, but the review did not touch the side of entities where we talk about what do we call them now? Institutions of what? The higher learning institutions. We didn't touch those. Yeah, the universities and all those. But we believe at some point the state may have to look at those, because the focus was purely around public entities.
No. I meant using them as a resource when going forward.
No, I wanted to start there. Didn't touch on them. I just want to say they are entities of the state which I believe at some point maybe they may have to be looked into. That's the one aspect. Using them as resources, I think it's going to be very, very critical to look at how they work with academies. They work with the state as well as the entities to look at how they really advance the whole issue of skills development, the issue of research and innovation. Development, one of the attributes that we picked up around developmental states is that innovation is critical. So between the research companies and the institution, that whole issue of innovating new areas for industrialization, new areas for driving some of the objectives of SOEs, that's a very critical area. Over and above that, I think, yesterday what we were listening to when we spoke to the SOE procurement forum, they were actually saying some of the areas they're looking into is to look at one or two universities to establish, you know, chairs for SCM, chairs for supply chain management. It could be chairs for mining, could be chairs for pharmaceuticals. We do believe that SOEs must start playing a critical role in that. The ESCOMs have very, very huge funds for their social investment. They should look at whether they can partner with universities to drive some of these special and scarce skills that they're needing to drive, and then ensure that they can use that platform for support and structured specialist research. I think I've touched on a number of all the areas, Chair, unless you have omitted some.
Sophia, thanks very much. And let me thank everyone for you know, their presence here. And I'm even, you know, technical recognition of the representatives from the oil companies. I'm sure they are also thinking as to whether, in terms of the project that we're handling now, we may have, you know, established adequate entities to advance their work. What is clear and what is emerging, I mean, it's a historical thing, is that departments on their own within the executive can never deliver as they are conventionally structured. There has to be innovation that we have to have various extensions, which are these entities in different forms, service agents, regulating, and actually financing wealth and whatever, you know, to ensure that the machinery, you know, works. And I'm sure it would have been nice even others within the energy sector could have walked in just to listen, because at the end of the day, influence cannot just come from the department, cannot just come from, parliament. The reason why we have public hearings is actually to be influenced, you know, by to think outside the box, you know, in a sense. I'm grateful, you know, in that respect. I won't repeat what has been raised, but safe to say that it's clear that from now henceforth, we're going to be seized with a big task, an additional task. All we need is to be creative and innovative as to how do we slot it in our work as a portfolio committee. Let me just round it up by saying a homework for us, honorable members. Sorry, I'm putting you now on the frying pan. Whether the frying pan or the fire itself. What is the role of parliament in all of this, particularly moving to micro-audit? Because we'll be moving to the micro-audit stage with a tool now, the report out of the macro-audit stage, isn't it? I think it becomes very important we look at that. What's going to be our role in that? Because we definitely would have to be involved, either partially directly or fully indirectly, in whatever way you see. And also both as National Assembly as well as in conjunction with the NCOP vis-a-vis SALCA as well. Remember, this does not just cover entities at the national level.
it covers entities at provincial level who, at the end of the day, link with us. It may not be here in energy, but as a very good example, once again, using my previous trade and industry, you'll have your FTC in Free State, your LIMDEF, your ECDC in Eastern Cape, and all those, they work with IGC at the top. And I mean, one time we were at the launch of the partnership between Free State Development Corporation and IGC, you see. And later we learned that even municipalities now are setting their own entities, you know. Whether we'll have outright entities that deal with energy, that's something else, but we may have at times entities that one way or another have to deal with some of the things that we're doing. What if one entity in one municipality decides to slot in at one of his projects solar water heaters? Because our target to this stage, and this Mamu Zungu, is still 1 million. But now we say our target towards 2030 must be 5 million. So some municipalities may start thinking that, oh, no. We must set up a special entity to drive this, you know. That sort of thing. So let's close on that, honorable members, that let's have our homework and look in that. What will be our role now? Because I hope I have a proper, correct assumption that once it goes down to more detail, that is micro audit level, we definitely, unavoidably, will be involved. Not much from an oversight side, but from other angles, public facilitation, because as I say, we're an activist parliament. We're not confined to just sit in these chairs, you know. We want to influence, but at the same time, we want to be influenced, you know, by fresh ideas out there in the public. If we can close with that would be very helpful. Next week, oh no. See, now I'm already in a full mode as if. Last week and this week and next week were committee weeks. For those who don't know, for us to do anything that we want to do without being interrupted by that big house, you know, that big house where we all conglomerate. On the 7th, we aim to invite ESCOM and the department to talk about imminent load shedding. Never mind what's coming out in the media. One factor they are, isn't it? I'm sure we'll agree on that, you know, members, because we can't keep on having this yo-yo in and out, you know, and propose solutions. But the approach is that let's have a joint session. I'll try and persuade other committees, two committees, public enterprise and the select committee for economic development. We come together and say, look, let's hear, you know, but we'll structure the whole thing, you know, nicely as to how do we handle this, because it doesn't occur well, you know. All sorts of things, confidence, what we call it, international and local business confidence industries, and all of that. And unfortunately, from the program you had last year, there's a change, and a dramatic one. Apologies for that. We closed the year assuming that we would be handling the ISMO bill next month, the whole of the month, which I'm sure everyone is keen on, but unfortunately, the process has not concluded it. I hope tomorrow NETLEC will close it so that the department can work on it to bring the bill. We've even not even in touch when is it, because, you know, we bend our fingers, you know, unfortunately, because we really were so confident that we closed it last year, having issued out an advert, know that by this time we'd be having submissions coming in and all that collapsed. But still, okay, there have been changes, and we'll share the items we've introduced in February to replace the ISMO period. Having all said all these encouraging things, I would also like to announce that Mr. Chinyazo Sidney Mpepu, the committee researcher, has decided to go to, they always say greener pastures, but where he's going to, I know, is more challenging. But he'll still be a researcher, and we must be grateful for him. Quietly, you know, you never know, see researchers. He was even reluctant to introduce himself. That's why I was pushing hard that he must introduce himself. They are at the back, you know,
they provide the information, and when you have were adequately or appropriately empowered, we forget to thank them. And when we get wrong information, well, I like a ton of bricks, a mega ton of bricks on top of them. But Bamuzanga, you know, Rolebuha Amanda, thanks for all your inputs up to now. Even last week you were with us when we had an oversight week in Tata looking at renewal. Rural energy, and also in Devon, when we're looking at the refineries, he was there. He helped us all the way. But also, we definitely, I'm sure, I can speak on behalf of everyone who would wish him success to where he's going to. I hope we've tempered him with enough steel so that he can handle the storms that he's going to go into. I've already told him that he's not escaped me, because I'm already linked one way or another to where he's going to. Honourable members, the department and all the entities, let me thank you once again. I'm sure we've been sensitized. I can't say and speak on your behalf that we've gained a lot, but we've been sensitized of what is in store ahead of us in terms of this exercise in the presidency driven by MPFR. And whether we handle it with, you know, optimism, with anxiety, unknown fears, but I'm sure at the end of the day, it's quite clear to us, it will make our entities stronger than before, and thus it will ensure that it improves the delivery by the government. Thanks very much. Until we meet again next month, the meeting stands adjourned.